The anti-eliminationist action any international political environment offers to combat domestic eliminationist politics has three principal components: prevention, intervention, and justice. The individual international regimes that develop around each of these anti-eliminationist actions can be institutionalized in international law, international institutions and federations' policies, and individual countries' law and policies. If and how this happens crucially affects the eliminationist assault's incidence, scope, and success. Prevention, in its broadest sense, means creating general conditions likely to inhibit eliminationist and exterminationist politics. An international political prevention regime, laws, institutions, and practices would work actively to create conditions that stop leaders from choosing to pursue eliminationist politics. It will even remove the practical basis, opportunities for success and getting followers to follow, for leaders to seriously consider such programs and for followers to be willing to implement them. The second component, intervention, has international actors, states acting singly or together, or international institutions spearheading member states, taking measures to stop specific mass murders or eliminations. These measures include diplomatic and economic efforts and sanctions, and military intervention. With clear and appropriate circumstances or events triggering them, individually or in conjunction with one another. The third component, justice, includes a wide range of necessary features, including punishing perpetrators and offering measures of repair, political, material, and moral. Repair is critical for justice, yet less so for reducing eliminationist politics. Hence, the ensuing discussion focuses on justice's punitive component, which itself has two critical dimensions: how broadly mass murder and eliminations initiators and implementers are punished, and punishment's certitude. Bearing these three components in mind, what has the international political environment been for combating eliminationist politics? First, unless we confine ourselves to large-scale mass murder, there would be little to analyze. The international community has responded to non-mass murderous eliminationist domestic politics with near-total permissiveness, offering no serious legal or institutionalized policy response except humanitarian aid to people insistently referred to euphemistically as displaced victims, as if it just somehow happened, instead of the expellees that they are. To lethal eliminationist onslaughts, the international community has taken occasional ad hoc responses, such as NATO's intervention to stop the Serbs' eliminationist assaults against Bosniaks and again against Kosovars. But each came only after the Serbs, whose murderous intentions and deeds were long known, had killed, burned homes and villages, and expelled their victims in massive numbers. Louis Gentil, the UN High Commission for Refugees head of operations in Banja Luka, Bosnia, in January 1994 wrote in the Globe and Mail, "It should be known and recorded for all time that the so-called leaders of the Western world have known for the past year and a half what is happening here. They receive play-by-play reports. They talk of prosecuting war criminals, but do nothing to stop the continuing war crimes. May God forgive them. May God forgive us all." In East Timor, success came after an even longer period of shameful failure. When the United Nations inserted peacekeepers in 1999 to forestall still more killing and expulsions, it did so only after more than 20 neglectful years, as the world, with a willful, blind eye, watched the Indonesians perpetrate mass murder, mass expulsions, and mass incarcerations on that island. These interventions, checkered as they are as successes, are all the international community has effectively done. Paralleling the past 100 years' overall international environment for eliminationist politics, the specific international regime of laws, institutions, and practices for action against mass murder can be divided into three periods. Prior to Nuremberg, the international community's treatment of mass murder mirrored other forms of eliminationist politics. It was practically a non-issue. Given international institutions' paucity, save for a few treaties such as the Geneva Convention, this comes as little surprise. The League of Nations, established in 1919 and a forerunner of the United Nations, was weak and poorly functioning. Institutionalized international or multinational state cooperation was restricted mainly to selected economic matters and issues of war. There were no prevention, intervention, or punishment regimes. The institutions did not exist. Even more, among states shaping international relations, the belief was weak to non-existent that international anti-genocide regimes were needed. This, too, should not surprise, as few countries were democracies. The powerful countries, democratic or not, were themselves imperial powers, either practicing or potentially practicing eliminationist politics, including mass murder in their colonies. The shock of the Holocaust and, more broadly, the Germans' predations across Europe, and to a lesser degree of the Japanese in Asia, ushered in the second period that can be called the United Nations Nuremberg regime. The victorious Allies established at Nuremberg an ad hoc international military tribunal doing three things. It created the first body of international law codifying aspects of mass murder under the rubrics of crimes against humanity and war crimes. It proscribed these crimes. And it provided punishment for them. This law became the basis for the UN Genocide Convention, passed in 1948 and ratified in 1949. The United Nations, formally established in 1945, created the first international forum and institution that, in principle, could effectively combat eliminationist politics, though the United Nations' initial concerns, preventing war, and deformities, that is, the Soviet Union's Security Council veto, the many tyrannies and eliminationist regimes as members, meant it would actually do little. In fact, the establishment of the United Nations and the specific body of law to address mass murder coincided with the Soviet Empire's onset in Central and Eastern Europe and the Soviets' ongoing and potential need to eliminate actual or imagined enemies, rendering Nuremberg's and then the Genocide Convention's substantial rhetorical and paper progress mainly empty symbols. True, at Nuremberg, at the trial of the major war criminals before the International Military Tribunal and then the successor trials, the most important ones including of the leaders of the Einsatzgruppen, the Americans held, the courts brought some leading mass murderers to justice and punishment. This was also true in the parallel war crimes trial of Japanese by the International Military Tribunal for the Far East in Tokyo and by courts in countries where the Japanese committed their crimes. Yet, all in all, the regime against mass murder set up in the 1940s and essentially unchanged for half a century proved extremely weak, almost mocking what was needed. It contained no prevention regime, which was not surprising, as no serious thought was given to what laws, institutions, and practices might reduce mass murder's incidence, aside from the toothless genocide convention. There was manifestly little genuine care about preventing mass murder, and for that matter, given the international community and its institutions' nature, little ability to act even had the care existed. Effectively, no intervention regime existed at the international level, and none was coming from individual states either. This second period saw an enormous number of mass murders and eliminations across the world, each met with inaction or approval, depending on the identity of the bystander states, the perpetrator states, and the victims. In principle, namely on the books, a punishment regime based on the law created at Nuremberg existed, but its implementation required a court and legal institutions to be created ad hoc for each mass murder. Given the general neglectful international environment, at times each superpower's active encouragement of mass murder, this happened rarely. More important, it was always unlikely to happen for the next exterminationist assault, and surely every political leadership contemplating mass murder knew this. Effectively, the punishment regime barely existed either. Most of all, the Cold War's paralyzing and murderous politics governed this period. Each superpower shielded its clients' exterminationist and eliminationist practices and tread lightly in the other's sphere for fear of local conflicts becoming general and going nuclear. This second period saw some progress. A body of law and an international institution, the United Nations, emerged that in principle could address or become the forum for addressing mass murder. It also saw certain publics recognize mass murder as a problem needing redress and by the international community. Countries could not be left to police themselves. So this period's developments, though anemic and self-condemning, created a slender foundation for a better international regime. The third period commenced during the 20th century's last decade with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the Cold War, a prerequisite for serious progress in fashioning an international environment inhibiting rather than encouraging exterminationist and eliminationist domestic politics. This was for two related reasons. As long as the Soviet Union existed, international law and international politics, as practiced among other places in the United Nations, could not develop an effective legal and political regime against genocide and eliminationist politics. The Soviet Union, the world's leading tyranny, impeded such change, even if Western-aligned states also perpetrated mass murder and practiced eliminationist politics. Any anti-genocide regime must include legal bases for the international community and outside states to intervene in actual or potential mass murdering and eliminationist countries. This was anathema to the Soviet Union because of all its abuses and because, as a tyranny ruling a multi-ethnic and restless empire, it always potentially needed such destructive policies. Second, the Cold War blinded American and other Western political leaders, not to mention Western publics, to moral considerations and political practices unacceptability that they pursued, supported, or tolerated in the anti-communist global struggle. While nothing could excuse such stances and conduct, it is nevertheless hard to believe that absent the Cold War, the United States would have supported or so willfully turned a blind eye to the mass murdering its Latin American and other client states, or for that matter any anti-communist regime perpetrated during the post-war period, such as the Indonesian regime's slaughter of communists and the Guatemalan regime's murderous and eliminationist anti-insurgency campaign against leftists and mainly Maya. The Cold War's end returned the United States and other Western countries to their natural, mainly cynical, neglectful state, which, however inexcusable, is far preferable to acceptance, connivance, and encouragement of eliminationist practices. Media and publics could expand their capacities to see more accurately and respond more, if still inadequately, appropriately, to the horrors of world's eliminationist politics. This third period, still taking shape, can be called the United Nations International Criminal Court regime, which perhaps will become the responsibility to protect international criminal court regime. Depending on perspective, its practical differences from the second period can be judged to be substantial or minimal. Media and the public are more aware of mass slaughters and eliminationist violence, which sometimes pressures politicians to act. NATO's intervention to stop the Serbs' expulsion and mass murdering in Bosnia, and then again in Kosovo, long after the assaults began, 3 years in Bosnia and a year in Kosovo, were qualified successes. Half-heartedly carried out with bombing, allowing the Serbs' assault in Kosovo to intensify and continue unabated for 3 months, the interventions eventually succeeded, the one in Kosovo halting the Serbs' string of eliminationist assaults. During the second period, this intervention never would have occurred. The establishment of ad hoc international tribunals, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in 1993 and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in 1994, with broad international support and legitimacy for all the tribunal's considerable failings, was a highly visible and positive development for punishment. The International Criminal Court's subsequent creation in 2002 is a significant step toward creating a working punishment regime. The court is permanent. It can receive referrals from the UN Security Council or member states and can initiate its own prosecutions. It has quickly established its legitimacy and function, having opened, as of March 2009, investigations in four countries: the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, and Uganda. In July 2008, it began to consider issuing an arrest warrant for Sudan's President al-Bashir, which it issued in March 2009. This initiative highlights the court's potential and limitations. Following the much-too-late-in-coming precedent of the Yugoslavia Tribunal, which waited 6 years before indicting Milosevic, the International Criminal Court tries to bring to justice an ongoing exterminationist and eliminationist assault's mastermind. If successful, it likely would have some deterrent effect on political leaders considering mass murder. But this arrest warrant is 5 years too late, after al-Bashir has orchestrated the mass murder of hundreds of thousands and expulsion of more than 2 million, which itself followed his even larger, more devastating eliminationist assault in southern Sudan, about which the international community has done nothing to punish him. From the time the court's prosecutor opened an investigation in June 2005, 3 years elapsed until he issued an indictment. The court then took the better part of another year to issue an arrest warrant. The arrest warrant, moreover, is only for al-Bashir himself and not the many other political and military leaders helping to organize and implement the devastating carnage. Perhaps a few such indictments will follow, and does not include the charge of genocide, being for crimes against humanity and war crimes. The UN Security Council can still quash the arrest warrant. Even if the Security Council lets it stand, the court has no enforcement capacity to apprehend al-Bashir. These substantial failings notwithstanding, the court's initiative is a beneficial new development. But for all the fanfare celebrating it, during the almost 4 years the court's creaky machinery took to issue the arrest warrant, and not even for genocide, the political Islamists have killed, raped, and expelled the Darfurians on a vast scale. And because the court and the international community, which so far has relied almost exclusively on the court for action, have loud barks with no real prevention or intervention bite, al-Bashir's reaction to the arrest warrant has been that of a leader with impunity. He has expelled aid workers and continues to attack the Darfurians. In the name of anti-imperialist solidarity, Arab and African leaders have flocked to his side and risen in his defense. This third phase's evident progress over the previous two phases holds out considerable potential for more progress. Nevertheless, it falls far short of what is needed. Even NATO's intervention to stop or mainly reverse the effects of the Serbs' mass expulsion of Kosovars and forestall probable subsequent Serb assaults in the region came many years, deaths, lives ruined, and mass eliminations late. The failures of the international community, its institutions, and member states in Burundi, Rwanda, Iraq prior to the American invasion, East Timor for 2 decades, Sierra Leone, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, and elsewhere have been all but total, as great or greater than the second period. Perpetrators have expelled, tortured, and slaughtered hundreds of thousands and millions of defenseless men, women, and children. The whole world, especially the United Nations, the United States, and the Europeans, has watched and done nothing, and France even abetted the Rwandan slaughter. The Genocide Convention, all but worthless, indeed counterproductive, remains the world's guiding document, and the United Nations, with all its built-in disqualifying problems, the leading institution. The United States, fearing indictments of its own soldiers and citizens, has not ratified the International Criminal Court, leaving the world's most powerful actor at odds with the court. Though how the United States will de facto aid the court's work is evolving and will undoubtedly vary case by case. With all its pathologies, the international state system continues to operate at arm's length from eliminationist politics, much as before. A practically non-existent prevention regime prevents little. An institutionally and politically extremely weak intervention regime produces few interventions. A considerably improved punishment regime institutionally is, in practice, cumbersome and partial, and in its appalling record of a few paltry prosecutions, almost mocks justice. The international community's stance toward mass exterminationist and eliminationist politics has been so limited, weak, and ineffective that it actually permits, tolerates, and encourages eliminationist politics. If political leaders based on their own country's domestic political landscape alone had wanted to opt for eliminationist, including exterminationist, politics, what aspects of the international system in any of these three periods would have deterred them from going forward? What in the international system then or today would prevent them from setting their policies in motion? What in the international system would have stopped or would today stop them from carrying them out? What about the international system would have made or would make punishment certain so that it even approximated justice, not the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia's four-year and unbelievably costly charade of Milosevic's trial, which ended inconclusively with his death? In each case, the answer is, effectively, nothing. Crafting a new international political environment to reduce eliminationist and exterminationist politics' incidence and scope requires that we consider such an environment's various possible features and the mechanisms to bring them about. Of course, any such changes depend upon states and their leaders in some fashion reforming themselves, admittedly a tall order. But, as we now know, our time has seen unforeseeable progress in other enormously difficult areas, including domestic civil and human rights, war, and imperialism. Such advances show that if the proper policies are designed with a realistic view of the current international community, taking its manifold weaknesses into account, then progress in combating eliminationist politics is also possible. Stopping eliminationist politics. How do we break out of this suffocating mass murder abetting cynicism and inertia? In principle, it should not be difficult. The world's non-mass murdering countries are wealthy and powerful, having prodigious military capabilities, and they can band together. The countries perpetrating mass murder and eliminationist politics, or tempted to do so, are overwhelmingly poor and weak, and each stands alone. Many could easily be stopped with a little military power and probably with other available, easily employable means. The powerful countries seriously applying their resources would radically change potential perpetrators' cost-benefit calculus, heavily tilting the scales toward non-eliminationist political options. What might a world standing against eliminationist and exterminationist politics look like? Of a political and legal response to mass murder and eliminationist politics' three components, prevention, cessation, and punishment, the international community should focus on prevention. For three reasons. First, ideally, eliminationist assaults would never begin, precluding the need for intervention and justice. We also know, or at least can strongly presume, that prevention works. It is manifestly so that our era's mass murders and eliminations do not constitute the full set that would have happened had no deterrence, no domestic or international preventive structures been in place. The simple fact is that democratic political institutions, in contrast to non-democratic or tyrannical political institutions, radically reduce eliminationist politics incidents. This fact alone shows prevention's feasibility and, in principle, easy achievability. Prevention works in many other realms internationally. War, how many countries would attack others if there were no military deterrence, and domestically, crime, to reduce undesired and proscribed deeds. Second, developing an effective prevention regime, whatever the difficulty, is substantially easier than an interventionist one, which the world's countries and their international institutions have shown no willingness to create. And with the Americans' difficulty in Iraq and Afghanistan, we'll be still less likely to want, at least for the foreseeable future. External intervention's recent successful instances, though heartening insofar as any such intervention is better than what came before, are less auspicious than they may seem. East Timor was a rare instance today of imperialist eliminationism, so it probably has little relevance for domestic eliminationist assaults, and even there, 2 decades of inaction preceded the intervention. The former Yugoslavia was the closest to some kind of proximity to Western consciences and interests, causing huge refugee problems and destabilizing the region. Yet even there, only after colossal human tolls did NATO, but not the United Nations, mobilize itself to act. So the status quo continues. Eliminationist politics, with few exceptions, stop either when the perpetrating regime finishes its job or decides for other internal reasons to halt the assault, or when the perpetrating regime is defeated in war for reasons having little, if anything, to do with the eliminationist politics itself. Finally, establishing a preventive regime is also preferable to relying on a justice regime, which operates after the mass extermination and elimination have taken their toll. Furthermore, instituting a preventive regime is easier than developing a regime meting out genuine justice to all perpetrators and not just a select few. That is, justice that includes some certainty of timely punishment and that fulfills the extensive requirements of perpetrators' political, material, and moral repair to right the wrongs and to repair the harm as best they can. In thinking about prevention, we should bear in mind eliminationist campaigns' frequent unpredictability. We need general measures that, by their ordinary functioning, will reduce mass slaughters and eliminations. In certain instances, an eliminationist assault, including mass murder's potential imminence, becomes obvious, as it was in Rwanda and Kosovo. In such cases, specific interventionist measures ought to be taken, just as intervention can occur immediately or any time after the slaughtering begins. But in general, and this is most relevant for crafting anti-eliminationist policies, we cannot count on foreknowledge or, in instances we acquire it, assume the relevant actors will decisively act to forestall the assault. Thinking seriously about prevention should build upon the analysis of the critical political and non-political factors generally producing mass murder and eliminationist politics. 1. Features about modernity itself and the modern state. 2. Structural relationships of certain states. 3. The international context or environment. 4. Beliefs about certain groups and understandings of politics and society that lead political leaders and their followers to think eliminating those groups desirable. And 5. Proximate factors producing the political opportunity and will to turn eliminationist desires into eliminationist onslaughts. In principle, prevention can take place and therefore target any or all of these factors. But as a practical matter, all these factors are not equally susceptible to alteration. If altered, not all would be equally efficacious in reducing eliminationist politics incidence and destructiveness. And not all are as easily or likely to be targeted with the necessary measures. Still, examining each one, at first briefly, can help point the way toward thinking more seriously about crafting effective and adequate policies. The modern state's enormously greater power and the concomitant awareness it can engage in transformative, including eliminationist projects, will only grow. Reorienting political leaders away from destructive toward positive transformative projects may be possible. Yet, if we think more imaginatively about the modern state's capacities, we see the international community has failed to recognize and exploit these capacities properly, and therefore to beneficially exploit and further this generally positive aspect of modernity. The modern state's transformative power, ability to monitor its domain, to influence and alter its every corner, and to learn quickly new possibilities, processes, and techniques from others, have been almost completely lost on the international community, regarding its members individually and collectively, considering their own international transformative capacities. The modern international community, like the modern nation-state, has enormously greater capacity to know what transpires anywhere in the world, including by monitoring its member states' actions within their own countries, and to effect change with direct intervention and by teaching lessons to its constituent members. Just as today's state capacity to effect transformative change dwarfs that of earlier states, today's international state system's parallel power dwarfs that of its predecessors. True, the international community's stepwise development lagged the modern states at home, taking off only after World War II with the advent of modern telecommunications, supersonic transport, and the United States' emergence as a superpower with a presence and ability to project power all over the world. The international community's capacity to monitor events recently substantially advanced even more, with satellites blanketing the globe, providing imagery even to private corporations and organizations, and to you through Google, with the Internet's worldwide instant audio and visual communications, and with all manner of economic, non-governmental, organizational, media, and other personnel, which together compose the de facto information agents of globalization and allow their ever-increasing penetration of virtually all countries. The international system's members have chosen, by and large, to exercise its modern strengths not on what goes on within its members' borders, but overwhelmingly on relations among its members. Despite having these enormous capacities, the international community's leaders have chosen not to reorient their decades-long successful emphasis from stopping violence between countries to addressing violence within countries, which is where eliminationist and other kinds of violence has overwhelmingly shifted. Thinking hard about how to translate the modern international system's vast capacities into commensurate practices that would diminish eliminationist politics can yield enormous benefits. In fact, any major prevention strategy's assumption is that states, acting singly and in concert, including by altering the system's fundamentals, do have the power to effect such positive transformative politics. While this seems obvious, it is not articulated or taken seriously as a foundation for stamping out eliminationist politics. And it compels us to ask, if the world's anti-eliminationist political leaders genuinely wanted to use their country's colossal aggregate power to establish policies to reduce such politics' frequency and destructiveness, what would they do? The second feature of our age's politics that has structurally transformed social antagonisms into the basis for eliminationist politics is the inclusion of all people into politics, meaning that they make or at least potentially will make political, economic, and social demands that cause tyrants and dominant political groups to feel insecure and therefore to be ready to contemplate using violence to eliminate their problem somehow. As Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet Cheka, explains, "We are terrorizing the enemies of the Soviet government so as to suppress crime in embryo." Even if the Soviets and other communist regimes took this eliminationist logic, by crime Dzerzhinsky meant all real or imaginary opposition to the regime and its policies, The logic operates in all non-democratic and tyrannical regimes, creating an eliminationist propensity. This eliminationist propensity and the insecurity underlying it is exacerbated by the dual transitions many countries face, to capitalism and to an industrial or more advanced economy, and to building a nation which necessitates all people's inclusion in a generally acceptable political and social compact. Each transition typically causes substantial social strains, political demands, and conflicts. An additional recent structural development, ever more disruptive to settled domestic arrangements, is globalization, which, with its international economic, cultural, and political influences, opens up and closes off opportunities to certain groups and people, creating winners and losers, whether they are ethnic, geographic, or class-based groups. These conflicts can create or exacerbate tensions, increase insecurity, and alter cost-benefit ratios, resulting in political leaders considering eliminationist politics. Although conflicts emerging from such structural conditions in themselves do not produce mass murder or eliminations, reducing such conflicts' frequency, scope, or intensity would diminish the basis for political leaders and elites considering employing eliminationist political means. The problem is that those erroneously claiming these structural conditions cause mass murder would also like, unrealistically and probably to the detriment of many countries' peoples, to stop or greatly curtail these transitions to capitalism and economic development, to nation building, people's full political inclusion into their country's politics, and to globalization. Whatever these modernizing and globalizing processes' unevenness and short and medium-term costs and transitions, whatever the considerable need to better manage them, they are surely necessary for general long-term greater prosperity. Within each country, domestic accommodations can be made to relieve the resulting tensions and conflicts. But that differs from self-defeatingly trying to derail these processes because they can engender conflicts, sometimes providing the basis for political leaders and their supporters to seek certain groups' elimination. Our age's third contributing factor, the international context, has been differently permissive toward eliminationist politics, creating powerful positive or negative incentives for political leaders considering the advisability and feasibility of slaughtering or eliminating unwanted and hated groups. This aspect of the eliminationist equation can be radically and effectively altered to reduce such politics practice. If, for example, the world's powerful countries created and honored an ironclad guarantee that they would invade any country whose people perpetrated mass murder or elimination, stop it, and capture or kill the political leaders, many fewer eliminationist assaults would occur. The tyrants and their cohorts, typically in poor and weak countries, would know that even if they did not care for their own lives or power, though most obviously dearly do, their now quixotic eliminationist policy would be self-defeating. How the international context can be made less permissive toward and more effective in preventing mass murder and elimination, short of such guaranteed measures, is discussed below. Whatever a country's existing strains and conflicts, ultimately the fourth factor, political leaders and their critical followers' understanding of the groups they consider pernicious or obstacles to cherished goals, leads to an eliminationist orientation or not. Such beliefs are typically grounded in often long-standing prejudices and hatreds, or derive from an ideological orientation at the core of the political leaders' and followers' stance toward politics, their country, and its future. So altering these views in the short or medium term, and thereby reducing the cognitive and ideological basis for eliminationist or exterminationist politics, is not feasible. Of course, if a new political context internationally and domestically lowers political conflict stakes, how political leaders and their followers view certain groups might also improve. This could be a secondary effect of other changes, yet targeting the potential perpetrator's beliefs and values is unlikely to be an efficacious preventive strategy. The eliminationist ideologies rooted not in classical domestic conflicts over territory, resources, or power, but in dehumanizing or demonizing conceptions of certain groups, would in any case not be susceptible to such changes or attempts. The most obvious, widespread, and dangerous such ideology today is political Islam. Finally, proximate factors create political leaders' opportunity to transform eliminationist desires into violent eliminationist assaults. Here, the modern international system's power can be applied, and policies can be designed to prevent opportunities necessary for political leaders to initiate mass annihilation or elimination from appearing. Thus, in the intersection of proximate factors with the international system and the context it provides, success in crafting prevention can occur. Having worked through the five major factors contributing to eliminationist politics, thinking in a hard-headed manner about prevention should continue by building upon the analysis of the immediate general conditions that produce mass murder and eliminationist politics. Political leaders deciding to opt for such politics are able to do so institutionally and have followers willing to implement the policies. The leaders, moved by a conception of the victims embedded in their understanding of their polity and society, or the ones they desire, and powers dictates, opt at a seemingly propitious time to eliminate the victims or their putative threat. Institutionally, they must be able to put through policies domestically and not face an international environment determined to make eliminationist politics suicidal. They must believe themselves to be powerful, effective, and immune. Followers must possess a conception of the victims and a sense of impunity and necessity that leads them to believe slaughtering or eliminating their neighbors and countrymen, women, and children is right and desirable and possible. A prevention regime cannot effectively address all of these elements. Eliminationist politics sine qua non, for political leaders only slightly less than their followers, is the conception of the victims, typically deep prejudice and hatred, leading the perpetrators to mark targeted groups as fundamentally different and dangerous, and therefore in need of elimination. This, though powerfully driving eliminationist politics of all kinds, is, unfortunately, strongly resistant to an international prevention regime. Why? Combating prejudice and hatreds is notoriously difficult and can succeed only with enormous effort from within the prejudiced society itself, which is extraordinarily unlikely to be pursued in countries such notions and emotions plague. Education, the hoped-for general panacea, is, in any case, not a viable short or medium-term option. This is so, without accounting for education's dubious effectiveness, in general because of ideology's self-validating and corrective-resistant power, and in particular when the education originates outside a country. Even when efficacious, which it has been on occasion in unusual circumstances after national or regional trauma and effective occupation, Germany and Japan after World War II, the benefits appear only after assiduous application lasting years, decades, or generations. Eliminationist politics' constituent features, initiation, institutional freedom to act, and implementation, can each be addressed. Even though the prejudices and hatreds, the conceptions of groups and peoples that dehumanize or demonize them, that typically move political leaders to slaughter or eliminate large population groups, are in their essence irrational, the first constituent feature of eliminationist politics, the leaders' decisions to initiate such programs, are still overwhelmingly clear-headed, calculated, and purposeful. In other words, rational in rationality's instrumental sense. In most instances, political leaders opt for such politics only when the opportunity appears propitious for success and to offer substantially more political and social benefits than costs. The international community can profoundly affect this calculus. If eliminationist politics' projected cost-benefit ratio became systematically weighted so the costs overwhelmingly outweighed the benefits, then such politics' incidence would decline enormously. If we focus on increasing the probability not that perpetrators would actually fail to kill or expel their victims, but that they would lose power and their lives, then several paths open up. A guarantee should exist that any political leader initiating a mass slaughter or elimination faces severe punishment. A guarantee should exist that his country's membership in all international institutions is immediately suspended, and a total economic embargo is placed upon it. These would end only when the eliminationist assault ends and the country's and the armed forces' leaders are dead or surrender themselves to the competent international authorities.